Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, is now the place for smart coverage of the 2012 presidential race and more. Right now on the site, see Joyce Pernick's analysis of how Governor Cuomo keeps winning in Albany, from budget cuts to same-sex marriage, at itsafreecountry.org. And in the final opinions of this term, the Supreme Court struck down a California law preventing the sale of violent video games to kids. And they struck down an Arizona campaign finance law providing matching campaign funds. These are both First Amendment cases. So now we're going to wrap up today's show with a wrap-up of the Supreme Court term and these final decisions. Slate's Dahlia Lithwick joins us to review. Good morning, Dahlia.
Hi there, Brian.
So we've been waiting a long time to find out about whether or not California is able to restrict the sale of violent video games to minors, or if that's a free speech restriction. This case was argued so long ago, back in November, I think, but they waited till the very last day of the term. How'd it come out?
It came out a slightly surprising 7-2 to strike down the ban, Justice Antonin Scalia writing a robust defense of violent video games today. The thing that was really interesting is that if you watched oral argument back in November, the person who seemed to hate violent video games the most and not want to include them at all within the protection of free speech was Justice Samuel Alito. He surprisingly put his weight behind Scalia and the majority today, striking down the ban. He would have done it on a slightly narrower basis. But it was really, I think, one of the reasons this took such a long time to sort itself out is that it looks like there was real kind of shifting constituencies among the justices right up until the last minute about who was going to take which side in this case.
Huh. Is that an indication that you can't always judge, as I think sometimes the media do, how a justice is going to rule based on their questioning from the bench during oral arguments?
Oh, absolutely, Brian. And in fact, I had posted something on Slate this morning, pretty much imagining what Alito's dissent was in this case, because he was so passionate about how disgusting these games were. And also, one should remember, Alito was the one person last year who wouldn't have included First Amendment protections for violence against animals, videos depicting cruelty to animals. So he had a bit of a track record for someone who was willing to cordon off certain kinds of really appalling speech and say, you know what, this is not protected under the First Amendment. So I think not only that, but also really his disgust at the substance of these games led everyone to think that he was going to vote with Justice Stephen Breyer and Justice Clarence Thomas today to uphold the law. I should add that Thomas and Breyer were the two dissenters in this case. So
there's an odd couple.
There's an odd couple, although, again, for very different reasons. Thomas has a rather amazing discourse on parenting in the colonial era, where he more or less talks about how Puritans viewed child rearing and how, in the end, this is all within the ambit of the parents. It's not anybody's responsibility but the parent to parent their children. Breyer doesn't so much talk about puritanical parenting. He just doesn't like this speech and says this is simply not protected speech. Scalia writes kind of a tour de force, Brian, talking about the Grimm brothers' fairy tales, Odysseus, comparing Dante with the game Mortal Kombat. So really, in the end of the day, this is well worth reading just as a cultural moment to see where these justices' heads are at.
Sounds like it. I'm curious about that Thomas dissent then, if he thinks parenting is only up to the parents and not up to society. Then why would he not uphold the free speech rights of violent video game manufacturers?
Well, I think, you know, I think in the end of the day, what he is saying is that this shouldn't be, you know, anybody's business but the states, I'm sorry, but the parents. But I think it's a good question, and I have to go back and read the whole thing. I mm-hmm. will tell you that Scalia takes a whole footnote to make fun of Thomas's version of parenting and essentially says that Thomas lays out a worldview in which nobody can tell a child anything without the consent of the parent, and that has to be wrong. So there's a little footnote smack fight going on between the two of them, but I'm going to have to read Thomas's whole dissent before I can really understand where it is that he's going today.
That's fascinating, and they're allies on most issues, Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia. Is there ever bad blood after something like that?
Although I will say that watching Scalia make fun of Thomas, watching him make fun of Sotomayor earlier in the term, you know, he does have a way of throwing elbows in his opinion writing. And there's long been, I think, a fabled sense at the court that he pushed Sandra Day O'Connor into the arms of the court's left wing with this kind of rhetoric, making fun of her in very, very strong terms in his opinion. So I can't say this is an ongoing problem. I can say, at least in one instance, we know that O'Connor didn't like the way he made fun of her and ridiculed her, not just ridiculing what she was saying, but in fact kind of suggesting that she was not too bright in certain places. So I think there are consequences to talking like this.
So should we look at this decision on violent video game sales to minors as the court saying, okay, violent video games are less like cigarettes, which do have bans on sales to minors, and more like movies, which the industry voluntarily rates G or PG or R or whatever?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly it is the case that the court, the way they approach these things is, what types of speech have we allowed to be regulated in the interest of protecting children? And what the court essentially says today is, we're not going to put a whole bunch of speech, let's call it violent speech to children, in that class of speech that we can regulate.
But, but there's a difference between regulate and ban. Could they regulate it without violating the Supreme Court decision, regulated in some way, like requiring warning labels or an age appropriateness code? That's different than banning the sales.
That's quite right. And there already are warning labels. That's one of the, you know, there's no question these things are rated. The question was whether you could fine a seller $1,000 for selling it to a minor, and that's what the court calls an all-out ban. I should also just point out, Brian, that there is a real fight between Scalia and the five who join in his opinion, and Justices Alito and Roberts who concur, but on different grounds. Going forward, there is still some confusion, as I read these opinions, about what a proper ban could look like. It's quite clear that Alito and Roberts think there could be a more narrowly tailored ban that would survive constitutional scrutiny. I don't think Scalia, looking at his opinion, thinks any kind of ban could ever survive constitutional scrutiny.
Dahlia Lithwick from Slate on the final Supreme Court decisions of the term, which just came down this morning. Then there's the Arizona campaign finance law, which is probably a much bigger deal for democracy in America. Arizona's Clean Elections program provides matching funds to a candidate once their opponent spends a certain amount of money. It was set up following a corruption scandal, and the debate hinged on whether the law was a force against corruption or leveled the playing field, something the court had previously allowed. And, you know, by way of local context here, we have public matching in New York. Candidates for city council and for mayor and other citywide offices, if they limit their campaign donations to a certain small amount, I think it's $250, will get matched like 5 to 1 by the taxpayers to wage their campaign. And it's supposed to be a hedge against candidates like Michael Bloomberg, who can come in with such deep pockets, and a hedge against, you know, deep-pocketed campaign donors as well. So Arizona also had this public matching system, and did the Supreme Court uphold it?
No, it did not, by a 5-4 vote, and it's a 5-4 that looks awfully reminiscent of last year's Citizens United, except now we have Justice Stevens out and Justice Elena Kagan in. By 5-4 margin, the Supreme Court says, note, this system is not constitutional. The one thing I want to point out is that the court does not strike down all public financing laws. What they do say is that Arizona's system, where there's a so-called triggering mechanism, where if your self-funded wealthy opponent spends a certain amount of money, then in a sort of staged system, you get public money as well. That's what the court has a problem with. So let's be very, very clear. The court doesn't scuttle all public financing. And in fact, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the five conservatives on the court, is clear saying we're not scuttling all public financing. But this trigger mechanism is unconstitutional, and it's unconstitutional for really interesting speech reasons. The opponents of this system in Arizona say that they are, in effect, wealthy and opting out of the public financing system. They are being forced, when they speak, when they spend their money to speak, they are being forced to subsidize their opponent's speech. That's the free speech argument they're making. They're saying every time I pay money with my funds and I speak, I am triggering something that allows my opponent to counter my speech. So, you know, really you have to do a lot of you know, chucking and jiving here to turn this into a speech claim, but it in fact is a speech claim in the view of the Chief Justice and the five conservatives. And so going forward, not all public financing systems are now shut down, but certainly there are several states that have systems that look like the Arizona system, and those systems are now unconstitutional.
What about in New York City? What do you think? Because here it's not triggered by how much your opponent is spending. Any candidate who plays by the campaign finance rules can get that public matching money.
I think it looks to me as though any system that doesn't have this trigger mechanism, and Justice Kagan is really careful, Brian, in her dissent to say, you know, this trigger mechanism is a way to kind of curb spending. In other words, they're not going to give you a huge amount of money. They're going to give you money that is staged to what your opponent is spending, so they do it in thirds rather than as a lump sum. It was an effort to be prudent, so that's the system that is now struck down. It looks to me that other systems that don't have that trigger mechanism do survive. Although I'm actually, just as I'm speaking to you, seeing a note from the Campaign Legal Center that's come across the transom saying municipal elections in Albuquerque, New York, and San Francisco use trigger provisions, so they may be invalidated going forward. So if, in fact, New York system is a trigger provision, as is this one, then it looks like it's in question after
that. Okay, well, I'm going to have to take a closer look at that and probably bring it on to the show tomorrow, because my understanding of New York's law is that it's not a trigger. It's triggered by how much you raise and in what kinds of donations. I don't think it's triggered by anything that any other candidate does. Perhaps I'm mistaken about that, but that was my understanding of that. So we will follow up and see whether New York's matching system for campaign finance is now in jeopardy as a result of the Supreme Court ruling. It is, just give me another 20 seconds on this, because it does seem like, in a way, it's a stretch to say you are limiting somebody's free speech by subsidizing somebody else's free speech.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's what sends Justice Elena Kagan, writing on behalf of the four liberals, into orbit today. She calls this, you know, a preposterous and unprecedented new claim, right, and then goes so far as to say the notion that, you know, you who have not been banned, you've not done anything, you are not even in the public financing system, right, have a claim as against the state. She uses the word chutzpah.
I guess the idea is that if you have a disincentive to spend more than a certain amount of money because that will trigger a new advantage for your opponent, then that at least disincentivizes speech. And we do have an opinion from the Brennan Center here in New York at NYU that argued in support of the law, and they say this decision will not affect New York City, so we'll see about that. All right, 20 seconds. They've accepted some cases today for next term. What do you know?
They accepted 11 new cases today. The one that I think everyone is buzzing about, Brian, is a case that has to do with whether the government can attach a GPS device onto a suspect's car without a warrant. In this particular case that comes up from the lower courts, they actually tracked suspected cocaine dealers for 4 weeks. So that case goes to the court next term.
And we may see gay marriage, we may see health care, Arizona immigration. That's all coming up next year. That ends the Supreme Court term for this year. We've done a number of segments recently. I hope we've informed you on these things. Listeners, and Dahlia Lithwick from Slate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.